Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Pat, and today I'm joined by Teresa, Heather, Linda, Nicola, and Steph.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
This week on Write Club, we're going to be talking about feature writing and sharing what we've been doing in terms of our own writing. Before that, Linda will be reading from her work in progress. Nicola will be sharing...
I'll be amusing, entertaining and informing.
As always.
No, not this week. I'm going to get you all working this week.
Oh. Steph will be telling us what's on her bedside table. But first, Teresa, oh God, it's Teresa, of course, is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Put pencil down, feet up, and just relax.
Well, I've made this as hard as I can because it's a really well-known book. Mm. This is clue one. This is a book that everyone knows but few have actually read. It was published in April 1719. Before the end of the year, the first volume had run through four editions. By the end of the 19th century, no book in the history of Western literature had more editions, spin-offs, and translations, including languages I may not be able to pronounce, such as Inuktitut, Coptic, and Maltese. With more than 700 alternative versions, including children's versions, some with pictures and no text. Don't shout it out. Pat's got a clue. Pat's got an idea. Shall I give you clue two?
I've got an idea.
Yeah.
When you said children's books, that threw me.
Okay.
Fine. Okay, clue two. The eponymous protagonist is a young man who rejects the path in life laid out for him, running away from home to avoid a career in law. His subsequent adventures include encounters with pirates, a period of enslavement, as well as participation in the transatlantic slave trade himself. Mm-hmm. But those are not the bits you'll remember.
Oh.
No, I think...
All right.
Finally, clue three. The novelist James Joyce suggests that the protagonist is a symbol of the British Empire. And to quote James Joyce, he is the true prototype of the British colonist, the whole Anglo-Saxon spirit, the manly independence, the unconscious cruelty, the persistence, the slow yet efficient intelligence, the sexual apathy, and the calculating taciturnity.
Mm. The only thing that I can think of is Gulliver's Travels.
Close, but no banana.
Mm. Oh.
Oh.
Oh. Oh.
Oh.
Lilliput.
Oh, no. Hal reads it over and over. Oh, darn.
Does he really? That's fascinating.
Mm. Jonathan Swift.
No.
No. Why can't I?
No.
What's it called?
I'm trying to remember. It has the Life of Bath in it and stuff like that.
No. That's Chaucer's Tale.
That's Chaucer's
Tale. It's not... Not something like Treasure Island.
No, but that's, you know, you're in the right area. You're in the right area.
Robinson Crusoe.
Got it.
Because in my head as you said it.
Yeah. So when you said Gulliver's Travels, of course, that's the other 18th century novel, which is not really for children, but in our culture has come to be a children's story.
Yeah. Robinson Crusoe.
So, Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe. Some people argue it's one of the first novels written in English. Others will say it's not really a novel, it's kind of a moral guidebook. Others might argue that Aphrodite's Orinoco, which predates it by some decades, is a novel. So, you know, there are arguments about it. But in terms of spin-offs, I mean, and its cultural influence, Treasure Island, as you mentioned, has the Castaway Ben gun in it. Swiss Family Robinson.
Love Swiss
The Admirable Crichton. In Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Emile on Education, The only book the protagonist of that work is allowed to read before the age of 12 is Robinson Crusoe, because he wants Emile to identify himself as Crusoe, rely upon himself for all his needs.
God, sounds like my father's choice of reading.
Yeah, yeah.
I was allowed to read Robinson Crusoe.
Oh, there you go.
Blighton.
So, yeah, and this is part of Rousseau's theory of education, allowing necessity to determine what is to be learned and accomplished. In the tale of Little Pig Robinson, Beatrix Potter directs the reader to Robinson Crusoe for a detailed description of the island, the land of the bong tree. And my favourite fan of Robinson Crusoe is Gabriel Betteridge in Wilkie Collins' The Moonstone. And he has so much faith in Robinson Crusoe that he sort of uses the book as divination the way some people use the Bible. If he's puzzled or doesn't know what to do, he opens Robinson Crusoe.
What would Robinson do?
Yes, yeah. Again, one of Wilkie Collins' great characters. And he considers a man but poorly read if he hasn't read it. A pantomime version of Robinson Crusoe was staged at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane in 1796 with Joseph Grimaldi as Pierrot in the Harlequinade. And then it was reproduced again a couple of years later, and this time Grimaldi was the clown. Where that fits in Robinson Crusoe, I do not know. And in 1815, Grimaldi played Friday in another version of Robinson Crusoe. There are operas, comic operas, and so on. Films. There's a 1927 silent film of Robinson Crusoe. The Soviet 3D film Robinson Crusoe was produced in 1947. Louis Bunuel, so even the most avant-garde director, directed Adventures of Robinson Crusoe in 1954. Walt Disney made a comedic version with Lieutenant Robin Crusoe, USN, featuring Dick Van Dyke. And in this version, Friday became a beautiful woman but was named Wednesday instead. Peter O'Toole and Richard Roundtree co-starred in a 1975 film, Man Friday, which sardonically portrayed Crusoe as incapable of seeing his dark-skinned companion as anything but an inferior, while Friday is more enlightened and sympathetic. So, again, you know, that's often nowadays, that's how Robinson Crusoe is seen as a colonial text.
I thought it was interesting that you said, this is your first clue, said this is a book that everybody knows but nobody has read.
Well, who's read it around this table?
I'm sure I read it.
You've read it.
As a child.
You've read
not
it.
Recently.
Yeah. I thought that clue was going to be the Bible.
When you say you've read it as a child, do you mean the Daniel Defoe novel?
Maybe not. Maybe
or
an
abridged
child's
version.
I don't know.
I read it
because it was
a chunky
book.
Yeah, heavy going.
Yeah.
Yes, they are. They're 18th century novels. They're hard to read. So there's also 1954 Miss Robin Crusoe, Robinson Crusoe on Mars, and so on. Castaways.
Carry on, Robinson Crusoe.
I was going to say,
why did they not do that? Well, they missed a trick there. Anyway, very influential book, which very few people have read, I would suggest, in its entirety.
You know, Heather, I was thinking about the Bible, too. especially when they said with illustrations and pictures and that
translations.
It had been made for children. Yes. I thought, oh, a Bible picture book.
but that wasn't published in 17-whatever, was it?
No,
was
the I don't know when it was published.
King James's version was
about 100 years before that. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Teresa, yet again. You nearly got us. Linda, I believe you've got another helping of Mary Magdalene for us today.
I do have. And I think we're allowed to have 600 words here, and it made me very sad this time because I had to cut this off before I got to another really good part.
Oh, well, we'll hear that.
That's a nice tease for next time.
Last time I read to you from my Mary Magdalene saga, Sheriff Dancy had been to the trailer house and saw what a horrible mess it was. And as he came out, because the trailer was leaning, it was a little unsteady, and he grabbed onto the door frame to steady himself. And when he did, He had a jagged piece of metal which cut his hand very badly, his right hand, and that's his gun hand. As you might, I'll tell you about that later. Okay, and here we are. They're taking him to the doctor. Eli had to drive the sheriff's car, which was a big concern to Sheriff Dancy because it's illegal to let anyone else drive it. But here we go. At Doc Sam's office. A short gray-haired man was unlocking the door of a red brick house when they pulled into the small gravel lot in front of the building. Two black iron posts held a sign that said, Dr. Samuel Greer, M.D., and under that, 8:30 to 4, Monday through Friday. He hurried to the car and opened the passenger door for Sheriff Dancy, who was struggling to open it with his left hand. Blood had soaked through the bandage and had dripped onto his uniform. Well, good Lord Almighty, Dancy, let's get you into the office. Can you walk? Doc Sam's eyebrows lowered as he looked closer at Dancy's face, which Mary Magdalene realized was turning pale. I think so, Doc, but he wobbled as he tried to stand. Eli was still in the driver's seat, studying all the knobs and switches underneath the dashboard. Mister, come over here and help me hold this man up. He's going to pass out in a Kentucky Fried minute. Mary Magdalene was out of the car like a shot. I'll help you. I'm strong as he is. She flung a look of disdain at Eli, who was now moving to open his door. Before the doctor could protest, the sheriff's knees buckled. Mary Magdalene grabbed his left arm and wrapped it around her neck before he hit the ground. Ready, she said, and she and the doctor marched forward in steps perfectly matched, dragging the sheriff along. Eli picked up the bloody bandage and followed. Lying on the examining table, Sheriff Dancy's eyes opened and closed like a sleepy man trying to stay awake. Doc Sam put a tight tourniquet around his wrist and poured some water on his hand so he could see the wound. How did he cut it? On a jaggedy piece of metal, he grabbed onto a steel door frame that had been tore up. Well, we'll see if any of it's lodged in here. What's that? Mary Magdalene asked as the doctor stuck a hypodermic needle in Dancy's palm. He did that two or three times in different places. She stood across the table from him and watched. That's something to numb his hand so he won't feel it when I start to sew it up. Is he bleeding to death? Not yet. It's a deep cut, but I don't think he's cut an artery. I see you tried to put some pressure on it with that knot. It slipped a little, but if you hadn't done that, young lady, as fast as he's bleeding, he might have passed out before you got here. Thank you for telling me that. She smiled at him, and he returned it. My name is Mary Magdalene. She watched everything he did, cleaning, probing, and disinfecting. After a while, she heard Eli get up and stand behind her, looking on. Doc Sam started some fluid dripping into the sheriff's arm and took packets with needles and thread from a drawer. Are you sure you want to watch this, Mary Magdalene? Some people get a little faint. I'm pretty sure that won't happen to me. I've watched Aunt Sugar kill chickens and take the guts out, and she took me to a hog butchering one time, so I don't think sewing up a seam will be as bad as all that. She grabbed Sheriff Dancy's left hand firmly and patted his shoulder. She didn't know if he knew it or not, but that didn't matter. What mattered was having someone hold on to you when things go wrong. Sometimes you can get to know a thing by its absence.
That last couple of lines, just each time I read it, it just gets better and better.
Yeah.
Which last two lines.
Oh, the last two lines.
The what?
The last two lines.
What mattered. Thank you. Yeah. I wondered if that was clear, though, that she knows that because the absence of that support has been her experience.
Yeah, I think we all got that. Okay, and that's fine. You don't need to overstress it. It's nicer as it is.
Two questions. One is it hypodermic or hyperdermic?
Hypo, isn't it?
It's hypodermic needle. Yeah. Okay. So you got it right.
Hypo under.
In Greek.
Oh, right.
Hypo is
of course, of course. And when you said... It slipped a little bit. If you hadn't done that, young lady, you might have passed out before you got here. How does the doctor know it was Mary Magdalene that tied the bandage
as well? Well, in a previous edit of the previous thing, Mary Magdalene had run to the store across the street and gotten some bandage materials.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then I added, she tore a bunch of strips off, and she was trying to bandage his hand. And she wrapped it around and then knotted the first strip really hard.
Yeah, but how does the doctor know that she did that?
Ain't nobody else there but Eli, and he knew he didn't do it. He couldn't even get
okay.
So he worked it out. Well, it struck me the same way as well that he didn't know, you know. Okay. And so it might, if she was to proudly say, I did that, or whatever, or something, or he says, did you do this, or, you know.
Yeah.
Whoever tied the knot was... Okay. Smart.
Great.
Because I thought, well, how would he know? They've only just arrived at the surgery.
Yeah. Which actually because the only thing that really jarred with me was, thank you for telling me that, which just seemed just slightly fake, false to me.
Yeah.
And I've got this thing about names, you know, like I seem to remember saying ages ago, when you're talking to somebody, you don't use the name.
Yeah.
You very rarely use somebody's name when you don't. Address them directly, and if when you do it in print, it just sounds fake. Just announcing my name is Mary Magdalene to me just doesn't sound natural.
Yeah, he had just said
maybe it's just me with a beam up on it.
Okay, I did that because he had just said young lady.
I know.
Yeah, it's a response to that. I think it's okay, and then he's very conscious of using this. Are you sure you want to watch this?
Yeah,
Mary Magdalene, and it did remind me of. When my daughter was 10, she'd have an operation on her leg, and we went to get the stitches out, and the nurse, female nurse, kept trying to make her lie down, and Molly was sitting up to look at what the male doctor was doing.
Yeah.
And the doctor said, let her look. And she watched, and she wasn't squeamish or upset. And the nurse said, oh, you're really not squeamish. You could be a nurse. And the doctor said, she could be a doctor. Thank you very much.
Wonderful thing. Pat, I'm going to take that into consideration because one of the things, when she said, thank you for telling me that, I thought it sounded a little, I'm not sure, but I wanted somehow for her to communicate that she was grateful for his acknowledgement.
Could you describe some body language?
Yes, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Right. Well, I took it as you meant it, but I agree.
Okay. Yeah, I could probably. Yeah.
Talking of body language, I really liked Doc Sam's eyebrows lowered as he looked closer at Dancy's face. I just thought that was a really good show.
Good.
Thank you. I love the you get straight into the detail. Makes these stories for me because you know, outside the house and there's a sign outside saying 8:30 to 4:30. I mean, you didn't need to put that in for any particular reason, but I think it just paints a picture.
It's Mary Magdalene. She observes these details and tells them to us. Yeah, I mean, I know she's not the narrative voice, but it's with seeing through her eyes, and she observes all these details.
The things that wouldn't necessarily be relevant become part of the painting of the setting.
She might even think, oh, doctors don't have to work very long hours. Maybe I can do that.
It makes it very visual. Very filming.
Yes, exactly.
It's like the crooked signs on the garage that they went to earlier. You know, I love that. And her unswerving curiosity that's not worried about being polite or anything. That's very real for me as well.
And she's as strong as Eli, and she can do what anybody can do. She's, you know, she's got that self-esteem, and it's great. There's this little paragraph here when he's getting out the needle. So what's that, Mary Magdalene asked as the doctor stuck a hypodermic needle in Dancy's palm. He did that two or three times in different places. She stood across the table from the doctor and watched. That's something to numb his hand. For me, there was too much time and activity between her question and his response.
Okay. Mm.
So if you said, what's that, Mary Magdalene asked as the doctor stuck the needle in, then him answering, that's something to numb his hand, and he did it a few more times. Yeah. That works better for me. It just seemed a long delay.
At first I thought you'd forgotten to answer. and then realised,
okay. Well, good.
Yeah. But very good, and laugh out loud, Kentucky Fried Minute.
I loved it.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
No, I like the thing that made me laugh was the fact that Aunt Sugar took her to a hot butcher.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, no, I've seen chickens have their guts ripped out. Yes, you do. Lovely.
Yeah. Lovely. Excellent. Yeah, bank holiday Monday, probably.
Let's go to a hot butcher in.
They also have cornbread festivals and all sorts of things. I think I mentioned last month that Mary Magdalene was going to start taking a different direction.
You did. I was wondering if this has something to do with it.
Well, it has something, but I had to, as I said, I had to cut off some of the good part. But what happens when he starts to take the first stitch is Eli just falls and hits his head on the floor.
No surprise there.
But there's a trickle of blood coming from the back of his head, so he's obviously concussed and he's going to have to... And they'll have to take Sheriff to the hospital, too. He's going to need a blood transfusion by the time he gets through with all
this. He's going to need a jab, too, isn't he, with metal?
And, and so what I was trying to do was to get both of these helper people out of the way, out of commission. So when what happens with Mary Magdalene, she's really going to have to work on her own to solve the problem.
In terms of historical accuracy, did they have tetanus jabs in the period that you're talking about?
Yes, but they had them with really, really big, painful needles. Remember when they had those, I don't know if you remember them or not, but they had the case the fluid is in. What's that? The hypodermic
syringe.
Needle. Yeah. They used to be in big metal. I'll check that, but I'm pretty sure it was. Thanks.
I would doubt he would need a blood transfusion.
Oh, really? How much do I have to have him bleed so he has to have...
he'd have to bleed a lot.
Yeah.
And blood goes a long way. You think he's probably only lost about maybe 50 mils of blood to soak through the bandage and the way you've described it, so he wouldn't need a blood transfusion. You'd be losing, I would say, pints.
Yeah, you're talking
blood.
Arteries, aren't you, before?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'll have to have him cut an artery.
And tell us about concussion as well, because you said there's a bit of blood at the back of his head, which means he must be concussed.
He won't necessarily be concussed. Right. Concussion is a condition.
Right.
So he's obviously injured his head, so you could say, an obvious head injury
you
or
might
something.
Need monitoring for might concussion. Need check.
Yeah.
Right.
Concussion is a result of trauma, but not it's not a given that that's what it would be.
Okay. I started first, I had his artery cut. And then...
An artery would gush.
Yeah, right. I read about that when I was researching. I thought, oh, that's bad. But then, so he had bled an awful lot in that scenario, a lot more than this. But then I was researching, how would you repair that? And I couldn't figure out how the doctor was going... Did he have to sew up the artery first before he sews up the hand and all that?
One of the things if you haven't picked... Heather will know this a lot better. This is from casualty watching. If you have something... Like, if there is a piece of metal embedded in his hand, they wouldn't want to take it out unless they were in hospital, because if it is an artery and you take it out,
it releases
the artery. Is there any arteries in your head?
Oh, yes.
They might also want to check for nerve damage as well.
Okay. I think... Probably what you could say is that, the doctor looked at it, and rather than try and stitch it up, I would say that the doctor could look at it and say, this needs hospital
care. Okay, so he has a piece of metal stuck in there, too.
You can see the metal. Mary Magdalene might notice, whatever.
Yeah.
And you say, I can't deal with it now.
Yeah.
You're going to have to take him to the hospital.
Right. And then Eli's lying there out on the floor with blood trickling from his head. They can't leave him lying there.
No.
There's nobody else in the office, so he has to go to the hospital too, and they're going to keep him for observation to see if he's got a concussion.
Yeah.
Now I've got them both out of the way for a while.
Well, yeah. So you just made it Heather with her.
Yeah.
Or a giant prehistoric spider.
Yeah. Not for the S word. She put stuff on Facebook at the moment.
Not allowed.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you. That was interesting. Over to Nicola, who is going to, what was it, entertain?
Well, I'm going to make you work, so get your hands out, please.
No. Oh, yeah.
So in the spirit of feature writing, I did a little bit of research about what makes a good feature article.
Right.
And I found some interesting things about it, which is that it's usually good news, and it's active voice. I wasn't absolutely sure what that is, but I knew one of you ladies would enlighten me. It is not time sensitive, so the story can be used at any time. It needs to be a true story, but creatively written. And it needs to include some of these elements, a lot of these elements, who, why, what, where, when, and how.
Mm-hmm.
So then I thought what I'd do is I'd find a human interest story, a good news human interest story, which is harder than you would think, to be honest. But I found one in The Independent today, and
not today, because this is 7th of October.
Yeah. Okay, I found one in The Independent. And I thought it might be fun to just start a feature article, perhaps the first paragraph, based on this human interest topic. You ready?
Well,
all right. And what I want to do is see which bit of it you find most interesting, because human interest stories can come from all different angles.
Yeah.
So here is your human interest good news story that I'd like you to start a feature article about.
Okay.
4-year-old walks 8 kilometres in sub-zero forest to help sick grandmother.
Sorry.
A true story.
So a 4-year-old walks 8 kilometres in...
sub-zero forest.
Do we get to know where that is?
You can just make it up. To help sick grandmother.
I don't think a forest is hot.
So I thought it might be fun just to start an article. I'm going to join you.
A few moments later.
Okay, let's go.
Okay, so who's going to kick off then?
Okay.
A red-faced 4-year-old girl burst into the bakery in Eskdale and pushed her way to the front of the queue. I looked around for her mother, ready to cast a disapproving look, but her coat was undone in this cold weather. Why are you frowning at
nothing,
me?
Nothing, I'm not.
Right. That's all I did.
Oh, very good, yeah. Interesting.
Well,
very good.
Well, straight in the statement of action.
Very good.
Yeah, wow. No, I thought, taking a different angle, the shopkeeper's angle and how they respond.
Yeah.
You know, this girl looks like she's not been dressed properly by an adult.
That was very good. Mm. Okay. Oh. Well, I'm ashamed because I used to be a feature writer. I wrote features for newspapers for years.
You shouldn't have told us that until afterwards.
Oh, well, okay, but I'm saying is that... Okay, a younger-than-usual hero emerged this week when 4-year-old Thomas Jones walked 8 miles through frozen forest... I forgot how far it was... to get help for his sick grandma. Nobody else was home, said the toddler. I thought Granny was dying.
Brilliant. I mean, that is very much in the journalistic style. That's spot on, isn't it?
Oh, I love that hero emerged this week.
Yeah, that is one hero emerged.
Oh, good.
All right, Heather.
Kurt Borgensen lost his mother when he was 2 years old. Since then, he and his father, Bjorn, have lived with Bjorn's mother. She has become the mother figure he lacked. So when she became ill, he knew he had to help her.
Excellent. Can I go last? Because I haven't done the right thing at all. But
grandmother Missy Elliott, former striptease artist, was unable to rise from her bed. Her 4-year-old grandson had to walk into town some 8 kilometres through the Siberian forest.
Excellent, that's so funny. That's a new one.
Oh, Daily Star.
The Daily Star, yeah.
That is excellent.
Oh, the National Enquirer.
Yeah. 80-year-old LCP body is calling for her 4-year-old grandson, Freddie, to get a medal after he walked 8 kilometres to get help for her after she fell off the roof. He's usually a timid little boy, and he knows that there are bears and wolves out there, but he just put his duffel coat and boots on and off he went.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
An 8-year-old woman on a roof, she must be great.
Go on then.
Well, I've done completely the wrong thing, but it doesn't matter. Okay, she loved the red hooded cape her grandmother had made. Oh. No one else had one like it, and soon everyone started to call her Little Red Riding Hood. One day her mother said to her, "Grandma is ill, you must take this basket of food to her." Little Red Riding Hood wrapped her cloak around her and set out, crunching the snow under her neat boots.
Oh. You can see it, can't you?
I think I got bogged down with the Sub-Zero forest. I thought, Norway.
And then I think that brilliantly illustrates what I was hoping to happen, which was that we all come at stories from different angles, don't we? And I think that was a great example of free writing as well. Yeah. And none of you knew it was coming. That was the best bit.
Well done. Well,
otherwise, I'd have researched some Norwegian type names. Yes.
Thank you, Nicola. That's a really useful introduction into our next segment. As we said at the beginning of the programme, we're going to be talking about feature writing, and it looks like we're already trying to answer the question, what is a feature? And we seem to have a mixture of opinions. Steph, you were disagreeing with Nicola?
Yeah, only that I don't think it's always a good news story. I think sometimes it can be a bad news story because, and in fact quite often, you know, magazines will go out and look for features on, you know, depression among young women, the suicide rate rising in men, or you know, anorexia, or, you know, bad news stories carry, which are human interest. I think human interest is the key. They carry as much weight.
Yeah.
You know, so if you've got a lot of graffiti in a town, your local newspaper might do a feature on youth vandalism or whatever.
I mean, it was me that actually suggested doing feature writing as an issue. And I think when I started, I was thinking mainly of the sorts of things you might find in, you know, Woman and Home, Good Housekeeping, that kind of thing. And most of those tend to fall into the personal experience category. You know, how I turned my jam-making hobby into a multi-million-pound business. They're always doing things like that on Good Housekeeping. Yeah. Or humorous reflections, you know, confessions of a clutter addict. When I started, I thought, well, that's a little bit limited. And when I started researching, it seemed as if you had to be a proper journalist to actually write feature articles. But once I got going, did a bit more research, I found that there is actually lots more potential. In fact, there are hundreds of potential platforms. And I'd forgotten, actually, that Linda, you were a feature writer in one of your previous incarnations.
I was, in an earlier chapter of my life. Some of the assignments were actually, because we had to have a feature. It was a weekly, and we had to have a feature on every weekly thing. And some of the assignments I got were strange because we couldn't think of anything else right then. A small town, not much going on. And one night, when grocery stores started staying open all night, I had to get up at 2 in the morning and go to the grocery to find out who was there and what they were doing, who shops at 2 o'clock in the morning.
It's for the journalists.
And basically there was a man there stocking shelves, and we had a nice conversation. One person did come in while I was there, but and another was, well, I don't know what we're doing. It's summertime. Have we got anything for a summer feature? I don't know what we're going to do. What are you? Oh, okay, ice cream. Everybody likes ice cream. Go around to the ice cream parlors and find out what the business is like. Mm. It was just
what the hottest selling flavors are.
But that's what I was saying about, I don't necessarily agree that they're always good news stories, because a feature could be that a community is experiencing a lot of knife crime.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A drug, you know, there's a drug culture emerging, or, you know, that there's a lot of graffiti and vandalism. Mm-hmm. That would also be a feature.
Stephanie is right about not always being good news. And this is a different kind of feature that I'm going to tell you about that was actually, it was a news story, but I was asked to write it as a feature because of the nature of the thing. A young man, I was in Rhode Island, Ocean State. The young man slipped off the rocks fishing with his brother and was never found. I mean, everybody was out looking for him, etc. And so it was news, but I also had to do it as human interest. So it was kind of a mix. I mean, there was no other news article to accompany that that told about that incident. And that was interesting.
Hmm. So how would you define a feature?
Well, I think a feature is generally much longer than just a news article, depending, of course, on the news. But in a news article, you get right away to what they call the nut graph, is like the first or second. You introduce, you know, in Narragansett, this, you know, the council met in Narragansett and discussed, you know, the rotten sewers or something. Mm. And then you go on to tell what happened at that meeting. In a feature, you can start, as we did here, with just, you're starting with a much softer beginning, something that's right into the action and not put into such formal newsy
ways.
So it's
more creative.
It's more creative
narrative
writing.
Non-fiction.
It is.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah,
Steph.
Very much
narrative
so. Narrative
non-fiction.
Yeah, I mean, the classic journalism, classic news story is the inverted pyramid structure, isn't it?
Yes.
Where you start with the most substantial or mm-hmm. most important information, and then you sort of taper down. I believe that part of the reason for that was because sub-editors were quite likely to cut off the bottom bits of your your writing in order to fit the edition. So the least important facts are the ones that go at the end.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
Yeah. So that's a classic news story structure. Whereas with the feature, it's much more similar to the narrative nonfiction or to even to fiction.
Right.
So coming back to your rotten sewer example, the feature would be perhaps about how the rotten sewers are affecting a particular part of the town.
Well, yeah, you'd probably go out to a neighbourhood and talk to Selma, who says, it's been backing up my house for a week now, and I just don't know when they're going to fix this. And her neighbor would come along. And you get some of the problem in real life before you go into talking about
who's
doing
something. Rather than just the factual story, you're getting the impact that it's having on people. And you can understand, you know, because if you say sewers is a problem. But then when you start to talk to people and say, you know, we have to live with this.
Yeah.
And it's really, I don't know how to keep my children clean. And,
you have to have a picture of people standing with their arms folded, scowling, and children in front looking very sad.
Yeah.
Always illustrated.
Fight off a rat the size of a small puppy.
But as well as that, I think in a good feature, let's stick with the sewers then, as well as the sort of the human interest and the people and the pictures.
Human interest, human excrement.
Yeah. You might then do some research about the company that's running it. You might do the science part, depending how.
Yeah, this isn't just a problem in whatever the town was that you said, but this this company are notorious because actually they have this problem here and here.
So after you lead into the story that kind of grabs the reader and gets them interested, then you back that up with your research and start talking facts, and depending where you want it to go, and that you need to give some indication at the beginning, I think, whether that is just going to be about the effect of this on all these poor people in this little small area, or are you, you know, do you have a bigger aim? And that's just sort of
you could drop the hook at the end that, of course, the company that's got the gig for all the sewage installations is the brother-in-law of the guy who runs the town council.
That can all go in a news story as well. Yeah. But I think in a feature article about something like that, instead of talking about the company and what they're doing, I think that at that point you would interview people from there and get them to... And talk about why isn't this being fixed, et cetera.
And it's like, you know, if you've got... you know, if the hard news story is... people are waiting too long in the accident emergency, as we would call in Britain, A&E. In America, you'd call it ER. There have been news stories about A&E queues going on for 6 hours. Mm. Well, actually, what better than to hear a few live experiences of people who've nearly died because they were left on a corridor in the trolley. Right. Yeah. A trolley in the corridor for 12 hours, you know. So that, and that, I think, when the journalists start to use that sort of in-depth profiling of individual experiences, it really brings the story alive, doesn't it? It becomes storytelling rather than facts.
It does. And it uses dialogue and it uses... as well as the facts. Yeah. And
it engages the reader with this. It engages the reader's sympathy and compassion.
Yeah. You said you said something about the opportunities are much greater than you thought. Is that because they're looking for features online, perhaps? Or?
Well, yeah. There is dozens, hundreds of magazines. I mean, I thought, oh, Good Housekeeping, Woman and Home. But in fact, there are lots of sort of trade magazines. There's stuff like Saga. I mean, I remember my car, I used to get a magazine from Mazda every few months, and that had feature articles in, and I'm sure...
All the in-flight magazines.
In-flight magazines. Those, there is, and that's print publishing. You're talking internet, and there are lots and lots of people who have space that needs filling.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking.
And actually, content linked to dates. So, for example, you know, when it's the anniversary of a particular event locally, I'm sure the local newspaper might be interested
in your
reminiscences of that, you know, that day in history or what have you. Because
as local.
And that's an opportunity to get your work out there. You might not necessarily get paid a lot for it, but, you know, it'll add to your writing CV.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Local history in the local libraries and that sort of thing.
That's why it's worth considering, because it is a good way of adding to your CV. It's a good way of sort of beginning to network and, you know, get your name known, get to know people, know who you can contact. Talking about local newspapers, I mean, local newspapers are dying the death in England.
Well, print journalism in general, they haven't... It's a big problem. It's an ongoing problem. They haven't worked out how to make online newspapers pay. People won't pay for them. But in very, very few cases will they pay for them. And so we will lose print newspapers.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. But you don't have to write a full article before you sell it, which is worth considering as well. Yeah, we talked about things. You mentioned anniversaries, but things don't have to be timed specifically to a news item, because sometimes a feature can take much longer to research and to put together, and they tend to be more sort of timeless in a sense.
You know, your top 10 bargain Christmas gifts, they're not going to publish that in January or February, are they? They're going to publish
that in November.
So you need to be getting it to now.
Yes, yeah.
Well, no, actually, we should have done it back in August.
Yeah, but you're not, you're not just big news item, I'll write a feature about it, because that's already that bit of sales,
don't tie
basically
to a current event.
But what I'm saying is, you don't have to spend lots of time and energy writing a full article that may never get picked up by anybody. What you need to do is basically like you do with your novel. You know, you give them an outline, you contact people with an outline, make a suggestion. You know, I've had an idea.
Here's the pitch.
And would that be the features editor you would contact?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you find out who the features editor
listed
is.
Listed on any good website.
So
good
you
magazine.
Check online, you check online, you get your contact details, you put together a good little mini CV, I suppose, your bio, make them interested in you as well, give them a sense of who you are, and give them an idea with probably a rough word count. And maybe a couple of alternatives. You know, you might do a shorter one, you might do a series, you might do a big, long feature.
And certainly with the technical expertise that certain people around this table have, you know, Heather, with her medical background, you could approach, you know, magazines and periodicals that deal with medical stuff and propose articles. Nicola could talk to people about, you know, being online. Pat can talk about education.
Well, one of the suggestions that were made about one of my short stories was about trying to aim it at a nursing magazine.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The geriatric thing.
Agencies have a magazine.
Yeah. I personally think Nicola should just pick up anything from the newspaper and write her cynical humour about it.
Well, actually, this was going to be my challenge to all of you, actually, and it's come up incidentally through this conversation, was to get something out there, to start your writing CV if you haven't got one already. So entering competitions, submitting articles, guest blog, anything like that, and then you can say, as a writer, I've done this, this and this. I was placed in this competition, or I've featured on this blog. So all your friends who are bloggers, see if you can, you know, there's something you can offer to them as a guest blog.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, one piece of advice that kept coming up was aim high, but expect to start small.
And even if you don't get paid, like that thing that I had in Total Eclipse magazine, he said, you know, there's, you know, we have a very low budget, can't afford to pay you this time. And I just thought, well, what the heck? Nobody else is going to publish this. He wants it. He likes it. Go for it. It's another publication.
There's mixed advice on that. Some people say don't give it away.
No, I know. I understand others, that. I understand that.
I think with you that it's a platform.
Yeah, when you're at the, hopefully the beginning of a career, or maybe this is as good as it gets, whatever. But when you're at where we are, you know, and you think, well, if he paid me, let's say £30, that is not going to change my life. I mean, it's not nothing, but it's not going to change my life, getting a one-off payment of £30 or even a one-off payment of £100. So, you know, it's a personal choice. But in general, of course, I don't think writers should be expected to work for nothing. Why should they? And very often they are, but that's another story.
Well, lots of you remember we spoke to Patsy Collins?
Yes.
And she was saying that, you know, lots of magazines will have Letter of the Week.
And that's a good way to start.
And that's a good way to start, sort of getting in with the people at the magazine.
Yeah, because they're not just features. There are those little kind of, readers' letters.
Readers,
things,
Readers' Digest used to do it, didn't they? You know, £100 for your in uniform stories and that sort of thing. I think, I don't know if Reader's Digest are still going.
I don't know.
There are lots of Facebook groups around calls for submissions. So you don't even have to go looking yourself. You can just join these groups and they will tell you, here's 30 good opportunities this month.
Well, apparently there are thousands of reputable webzines and paying blogs online. It says many of them don't pay for writing, but those that do, you generally get paid a flat fee for a 300 to 500 word article. In terms of money, about 70p per word in the UK.
No, 70p
per word.
So if you write a 100 word article, you'd earn £700.
If you wrote a 1,000 word article, they wouldn't give you £700, believe me.
No. Well, maybe they missed out on the article I read, maybe they missed out.
A zero.
As a point. Decimal point.
That doesn't sound too
It said
right.
60 cents per word in New Zealand and Australia, and then 70p per word in the UK, and two rand per word in South Africa.
I've seen 2p a word and 3p a word.
Right.
0.7p a word.
Well,
maybe.
Let's find these magazines that are paying 70p.
And as a final, I mean, I get a lot of people, because I've got a very active blog that I never publish anything external on, but I get, I must come up in some search engines or other, because so many people contact me and say, can I put an article on your blog? Because they want the link back to their blog. And I always say, well, send me an example. And, you know, they obviously haven't researched what my blog is actually about at all, because the example they send is completely not no good. But so that's the thing, is I would definitely familiarise yourself with, in fact, that's what our interviewee said, wasn't it? Familiarise yourself with the publication before you submit anything.
Yeah.
Do you know, FutureLearn actually does a course, a free course on feature writer.
That's a good one.
And
something for the winter.
Yes, absolutely. So have a look at Future Learn. I don't know when they're running it again.
Feature World?
No. I just looked at Future Learn because they're always a good starting point.
No, Feature World is actually, I think it's more like an online agency who will find markets for your features. Because it will deal with all the legal aspects and so on. Make sure that you get paid the right amount and so on.
I found a good article online on thoughtco.com, an article by a guy called Tony Rogers just from a few months ago. And he talked about, you know, news features, profiles of interesting individuals, spot features, which are, you know, tends to focus on... So say there's a hurricane and you actually do a sidebar which says here are all the hurricanes that have hit that place. And then a trend story, which would be lifestyle, fashion, cooking, high tech, entertainment. So, you know, if you are a vegan and you're living in an area, as I do, where vegan cooking is suddenly everywhere, everywhere's got vegan, gluten-free in the window, and you know about that and you have the authority to speak about that, and then try writing an article, because that would be called a trend story.
Or the difficulties of being a vegan in a place where it's not widely recognised.
There's always an angle, isn't there?
And I think for a lot of people, the obvious route is the human interest story. Or you mentioned before the sort of family history, that kind of thing. And the local interest stories. I mean, one guy that is now a sort of fully-fledged writer, successful writer, apparently does a lot of ghostwriting, said I think his first feature was he happens to love cats, and he did about 500 words on cats and what that had taken up. And then he did one about...
Surely there's nothing left to say about cats.
Some people will read anything about cats. But the human interest ones, the real-life experience, there are dozens and dozens of those. You get in, like, Woman's Own, Bella, that kind of thing. And they're perhaps an easy route in, get yourself started.
And many magazines will have like a back page reserved for, you know, some kind of human interest story or things like that. That's
some
just
magazines
there for
are just
the
full of human interest. Yeah, some magazines are just human interest.
That is true.
So you have to come up with some sort of lurid headline
to
describe a fairly ordinary everyday occurrence.
Heather's about who was that your grandmother?
Finding the angle.
Missy Elliott.
That well known Siberian.
Suffering from hypothermia. Thank you. I hope some of you found some of that useful, gave you some food for thought. So maybe next month when we talk about our writing lives, we'll all be sharing some of the features we've written. I know last time we talked, just after our summer break, there was quite a lot of talk of reading and that perennial favourite, research. But I expect you've all got stuck into some real writing projects since then. Yes. Okay. Steph, go on. Tell us.
Well, I've been quite inspired. I mean, I did mention about poetry after the summer break that I was finding myself writing snippets of poetry. And I've sort of picked those up and fiddled with them. So I've done anything too exciting. I've had a bit of a new burst of energy on Grace. I've gone back and revised a few of the scenes there. I have another rejection. I'm up to 14 now.
One more on your way. You're eighth of the way there.
But I've got a few more submissions that they've either gone or I'm working on them going. I'm talking now less to agents and more networking, like through people that I know for introductions and direct approaches to independent publishers.
Are you thinking self-publishing yet?
No, not yet. I think I would go to crowdfunding.
I was going to say you'd go to Unbound before you do
I think I would. Because I just feel that I need the validation of that team around me. And, you know, I want to have those checks and balances. You've got to be brave. Go out there and do it any other way. It's just a personal choice. But I'd never say never. I'm having fun and I'm feeling creative and I'm feeling energised.
Well, that's good.
I'm very tempted to do, not NaNoWriMo specifically, but I'm very tempted to sort of blank out 30 days at some point in the winter and tell you all you can't speak to me for a month.
Well, maybe we should do some, we should think about that together, not necessarily physically being in the same space, but whether we set a challenge and we all sit down and do it. So that would be a good thing.
That will make Right Club meetings quite interesting if you can't speak to you.
We did a retreat a couple of times where we all went together to a place and not any of our homes, but to a separate place, and then we wrote, then we'd break and talk about it, and then we'd write some more, and then we'd have wonderful lunch and wine, etc. It was great. Why don't we do another
retreat?
It's just
the lunch and the wine, really.
I'll come for those parts.
Yeah,
I'm not very good after lunch.
We'll have late lunch. Okay, thanks, Steph. Who wants to go next?
Well, I said last time that I was writing to enter the competition for the Manny Lit Fest. And unfortunately, the story's written itself. What I intended to write...
How was that unfortunately?
It's not come out how I expected it at all. The story I wanted to write was, I thought, was firmly in my head. And, you know, either the pen or the keyboard have gone its own way. And now I've got to do some research to make sure the facts that I've put in are correct. Rather than just a blanket, oh, you know, this happened. But it's been interesting, even though it has written itself.
Right.
So maybe the original idea is something for later on.
Right.
But that's next week, isn't it, the Manny Lit Fest?
But the competition closes later.
Yes, the competition doesn't close until the end of the year.
End of November, I think.
So I've still got a little while to do that.
Okay, good. Teresa.
Well, I picked up a bit of a challenge from 5 or 6 weeks ago when we talked about horror, because I thought it's not my genre, but the idea of writing something creepy, even just a little short passage. And again, a couple of weeks ago, we had a bit of Grace, which was a little bit chilling, a little bit creepy. So I'm working on that. But I'm focused on some competitions that are coming up. So there's a couple of things. There's a travel writing competition I might have a go at. There's a screenplay competition. Again, I'll share all the links on the Facebook group of any that are relevant. But really, I want to focus on the Bath Children's Novel Prize. And for that, what I need is to get the first 5,000 words of Franella really sharply honed. So I will be asking for your input and support. I'm going to do a little bit of work and then I'll be sharing it with you guys. So that's my main focus at the moment, and I need to write a synopsis and everything for that.
How many words have you done so far?
I've got about 20,000. Wow. I think I'm about halfway.
Halfway.
And I've carefully read the competition, and it doesn't anywhere actually say you must have a finished manuscript, although it does say the manuscript should be about this length if it's a middle grade novel or whatever. It tells you the recommended word lengths, but
if you're shortlisted, you have to send it in within a week or 10
did it,
days.
I didn't see that. I will check. Okay. But anyway, I'll just have to write it really quick.
That's your deadline. That's your deadline. So you can put it in and then wait for the, because it will take.
Well, you know,
a few months.
We all work better with a deadline. If not this year, then next year.
That's the deadline.
So that counts for the long list and then the short list to come out. Right. So you just have to be ready to submit for that.
Yeah, keep at it.
Okay, brilliant. Nicola.
No, there's no point in asking me. do you want me to be honest?
Yeah, go on.
I don't know if I want to carry on writing, because I don't know if I'm ever going to be any good enough. I think I've certainly got ideas. I think my writing style is too colloquial. And I'm just feeling very that there's other things I could do better with my life.
There's no such thing as too colloquial, and your style is your style. And we all think you're a very talented writer. And I think with some of the things, you know, as you know, I've started novels before and not completed them. And maybe
that's
I'll go back
the
to
the apprenticeship. I need to move
exactly.
On
maybe
else.
I'll go back to them. Maybe I won't. But if you feel, because I know you said you feel you're like a bit like you're going nowhere with Brianne, put it to one side. Yeah. If you want to go back to it,
I've got two or three other ideas.
Exactly.
I have been playing with the idea of doing something the Story Grid people suggest, which is taking one of their blueprints of a classic novel and then trying to put one of my ideas on top of that, which may or may not work. I don't know.
Yeah, because I mean,
you've said yourself, you've come into writing cold, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, apart from, I do a lot of writing for work.
Yes, yeah. Fiction writing. You've come into that, like, completely cold. And so to go straight in
to a novel
and publish a trilogy, yes. It's a little...
She's not ambitious.
Ambition's great. But maybe
I need to put Brianne to one side because she's not inspiring me at all.
No, you're getting bogged down.
And also, when you started with that, you were in a different place...
Mentally.
Personally, yes. Weren't you?
Yes, yeah.
And it's a good purpose at that time,
it
I believe.
It was a bit cathartic at some point. Mm. Yes, it was.
Yeah. But Nicola, I really love your writing because you have such humor. You have such good ideas. I mean, the donkey.
The donkey that I'll never live down to.
But no, that piece you wrote about the sounds of Sydney.
Yeah,
that's really excellent piece of writing.
Well, I really appreciate you being so kind, everyone, because I have felt quite discouraged recently. So.
Oh, no.
But perhaps I'll try the story grid thing, because listening to the podcast of where the woman who writes Regency romantic fiction has written a story set in that time based on the Brokeback Mountain story has come out, you know, that I felt quite inspired by that. So perhaps if I... stop worrying about the structure of everything because I kept getting bogged down in the structuring of everything and then just wrote because the ideas, I mean, they don't stop coming.
So
perhaps that might be a way
and
to do
it. And as Teresa said, Teresa's been writing seriously for more than 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's only really just found an idea that has flowed enough legs to keep you at it.
I think so.
Week out.
I think, you know, I mean, not to bring it back to me, but, you know, thinking up characters and situations and starting things off I find quite easy. But what I'm learning is I need to be plotting and has it got legs? Is there enough meat in this idea to carry a novel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not everything's a novel.
If not, write a short story. Yeah.
And I was just going to say, why not try short stories for a while?
You could enter the competition that Heather's entering.
That's a good point.
Because then you can sort of hone the writing.
I think it's because I can't write what I like to read. That's been... And the more I read, the more fabulous books I read, the more discouraged I get because the bigger the gap feels.
Mm.
Did you ever feel, Teresa, that you didn't want to write anymore or have you ever taken long gaps?
Sometimes I think, why am I wasting my time? Because there are hundreds of books, really good books, that I want to read.
And why am I wasting my time trying to write a book when actually I could sit down and read it?
Read
something 10 times better. Yeah. And, you know, I'm doing it. I'm just doing what I'm doing. It's not earth shattering. It's not going to change the world. It's not hurting anybody either. And I'm just doing it.
And it is. It's about enjoying it.
Right. Mm-hmm. I write with no structure. I just keep writing scenes as they occur.
Yeah.
I think, that would be fun. And then I write it, but I do better with deadlines. But anyway, I don't know where mine begins, actually. I don't know yet where the middle is or anything, so I'm not following any structure. I don't have any rules for that, which is really not good in a way because, you know, you have to know where you're going sometime. But I keep thinking, well, if I keep writing these little things that have some meaning, at some point I'll say, that can, you know, follow this or whatever. But if I had to try to follow the structure, and I know you have studied a lot about that and done a lot of it, if I had to do that, I think I'd quit because I just would find it so hard.
Different things work for different people, don't they?
Nicola likes to have
that.
Well, I'm going to be spending a lot of time with, you know, a lot of spare time on my hands shortly because I'll be in a country where the weather is absolutely appalling. So I anticipate the boredom will drive me back to it.
I've got a big project on a work project.
Yeah.
So that's going to interfere with writing time. But you know.
A work project?
Everyone's faces.
You know, things you get paid for.
Yeah.
Okay. So what about you, Linda? What have you been doing writing-wise?
Well, as I said, I keep writing these scenes that
I find interesting, or I find I can make this funnier. Wouldn't it be funny if that happened? And so I write them as I think about them, especially if there's a deadline coming up. And but they don't. I don't have anything that's put together, chapter one, chapter two, etc., like that right now. And I don't know when or if that will ever happen. I just keep thinking, well, I just keep writing about this little girl, and I like her. But kind of like,
do you know how many words you've got approximately? Are you keeping track of that?
I think you guys have asked me that before, and I have tons of words on material that I know is not going to be useful anymore. Because I've written several times trying to get a feel for it, and so of words that are usable, I probably have about, 20,000 to 30,000, I think, of words that are works that are usable. But that's not very much, and they're not all tied in together.
It's a third of a book.
So,
But also, I'm beginning to feel now, because I'm sort of noting as I go along, I need to go back and put that in, I need to go back and put that in, that actually, when I get to the end of a first draft, when I go through a second draft, it's going to grow. I feel it is going to grow because there are things that need a bit more detail or a bit
because you focused so far on like telling the story.
Yes, yes. And I want to intensify the emotions or so I think it will grow a little bit. So I'm not worried about the words. I know 40,000 to 60,000 is what I'm aiming for this age group.
Yeah.
But if I get to the end of the first draft and it's not quite there, I won't be too worried. Mm-hmm. I don't want to pad it. I don't want to force it. I want to make it good.
Right. My first draft was about 80,000 and it's now 83.
Yeah.
Really?
And actually I've cut swathes of it out.
Yeah.
Right. Cut out huge amounts of words. Uh-huh. But as you say, when you go back and you think, no, I need to make that point more clearly, or that needs an extra scene because it's not clear that... Mm-hmm. And even now I can think of things that need to go in it.
Yeah.
One of the things I've done through all of this writing and things that I have to just kind of put it and say that's not usable, but I don't throw it out. But I started off with Eli being an absolute horror and just being a fanatic, and poor Mary Magdalene is trapped with this father. But now Eli has changed over time. Eli has changed so much. And sometimes when, like in this piece I just read, I portrayed him as being rather inept because Dancy needs help and he's looking at the switches under the dashboard on the sheriff's car. And other times I show him as not really being inept. And I think, okay, I have to make a decision about what this is, and I also am concerned now about why Mary Magdalene resents him or has this attitude toward him. And
I think we can all be inept some of the time and not so inept at others. I think that's human beings are not consistent. But I think Mary Magdalene resents him because he's just, a bit ineffectual and a bit dumb, and she knows she's smarter than him, and she can see somebody's got to help this guy, and he's a bit like, oh, what should we do?
He doesn't know where the money's going. She knows how much it's going to cost.
I don't have a problem with their relationship in that.
And he doesn't.
But also, he's not, he has become a more sympathetic character. And I think because as a writer, you've got to have some sympathy for him. Oh, you can't just be a villain, a horrible, if you're going to live with him through all these pages. But also, it's quite natural that from a child's point of view, I think everybody has situations or can remember things where, your dad's all right. And you think, you don't live with him. You don't know that. And from a child's point of view, he's not. He's useless or whatever.
Embarrassing.
Yeah. So that's part of her learning and part of her growing up to see that maybe he's not such a waste of space as she thinks he is.
I remember my son at 13. I said to him, bring your friends home. You don't have to keep going out all the time. And he said, I couldn't bring anybody home because of your curtains. My curtains were just too embarrassing for him.
What were your curtains like?
They were kind of Regency striped in red and gold and green.
That's right.
Well, I'd kind of done this Edwardian gentleman sitting room vibe.
and, you know, with tartan. It was a bit kind of Christmas tree-like, I must say. Right. He just thought it was revolting and couldn't bring anybody home.
Isn't that funny?
What sensitive. A sensitive 80s, 90s
fan. Late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah. As if they walk into each other's houses.
That's how children are, isn't it? Young people when they say they come aware.
And to be honest, I would want to look at the knobs underneath the dashboard in a blue scarf.
I was quite surprised you didn't accidentally set the blue light in the siren. That would be quite fun. You can have that for free.
I thought about doing that. And which would just, you know, mortify Dancy because he's not supposed to have...
And also mortify in. Mary Magdalene.
Oh, yes, yeah. Anyway, so I have a lot of ideas about that. But as I said, I'm still just putting these things that come to me together without thinking about sequence or...
Well, that's fine because I was thinking when you get to, you know, 50,000 words or something and you feel like you're getting close to Little Rock, maybe that's the time to worry about the sequence and the order and for the moment just go with it.
So I've been going for an hour and a quarter.
Okay. Oh, my God. Yes. So, Pat, what about your writing life?
I thought I was going to get away with it then. Well, I said last time that I've been making lots of... little sort of notes.
Doing research.
No. Observations. I was doing observations.
Oh, a new one.
Okay, like Teresa, you can have that one for next time. And I've just been sort of writing some of them up, just practicing. Thinking I'll find a spot for that at some point in the future, but not just yet. But I'm working on it.
Yeah. How's your Greek series coming along?
Greek series, yes. We're still, Maggie's still, I'm sort of holding that back for you for another time.
Okay, good.
Yeah, looking Maggie's on now. Getting there.
Did you submit Mark somewhere? Because that really, I thought that's ready to go.
No, I didn't. Maybe I should look for somewhere to do that, to meet Teresa's challenge. Yeah. Okay, well, it's... nearly time to wrap up for this week, but before we do, Steph's going to tell us what's on her bedside table.
Yes, well, I am reading a book, which is a book club book, and it's a picaresque novel. It's called The White Tiger by Aravind Adiga, first published in 2008, and it won the Man Booker Prize in the same year. Now, 2008 was also a year when I was sent by the company I then worked for. I was sent to India for 3 months. What's fascinating about this book is it's actually based in India and it's based in the time I was there. It's the story of Balram Halwar, who's a village boy, and it details his journey to Delhi and then becoming an entrepreneur and setting up a taxi business and so on. It's amusing. I'm sure it has. I'm not a long way into it. It's dark humour, I would say, because we're looking at class struggle. We're looking at India as a sort of globalised world. I remember when I was there being shocked by how many people slept under plastic on the streets, didn't have running water, but everybody had a mobile phone, you know, and it was that kind of juxtaposition of, the two very different ways of living. And I remember also, you know, talking to young women whose income supported entire families, but they weren't allowed to go out without their father's permission, despite the fact they were the major breadwinner in the house and that kind of thing. So for me, it's kind of taking me back to a time which I remember well and seeing things through his eyes. So it's called The White Tiger, Aravind Adiga, and I'm very grateful to... the lady that decided that our book club is going to read it, because I'm enjoying it very much.
Very good. Thank you for that. Well, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll take something from it and that you'll join us again next time. But meanwhile, why not visit our Write Club, the podcast Facebook group and let us know what you think. Goodbye till next time.
Bye. Bye.